supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Welcome to another thrilling episode of You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I am your host, Mike McGrath. Coming up later in the show, a young man in the Midwest is getting bit to death by mosquitoes, and repellents don't seem to help. He wonders if the lack of dragonflies at their pond might be part of the problem. We'll delve into that. We'll tell you how to attract dragonflies, and we'll get more into mosquito prevention and protection after a lot of your protective phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Ashley, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Thank you so much.
Well, thank you, Ashley. How are you?
I'm doing pretty well. Busy.
Yes, and where is Ashley busy?
I'm in Carneys Point, New Jersey.
Carneys Point. Is that where the carnivals put up for the winter?
I have no idea. I just know I'm right by the Delaware Memorial Bridge.
All right. What can we do for Ashley in the Garden State?
I was wondering about my raised bed garden that I created last summer, which I filled with quite a generous amount of mushroom compost mixed with garden soil. Last summer, I definitely had a lot of nitrogen, I assume, because my tomatoes turned into a tomato forest.
Right.
It's right inside my chicken coop run, which is quite large, so it grew right through the ceiling and out the sides. This year, I'm noticing, even though I planted everything late due to weather and inconvenience, that not much is flourishing except for my zucchini squash, which also looks kind of overgrown.
Well, the mushroom soil, was it aged or was it still hot?
No, it definitely was aged. And I did leave out a detail that over the winter, I let my chickens go through there. And I did wait a while after they were out of that area before I put plants in it.
So the chickens don't roam there during the gardening season?
Correct.
Well, the main component in mushroom soil is horse manure. What your chickens are depositing in the winter is obviously poultry manure, and all of that is very high in nitrogen. Have you done anything to balance that out?
I contemplated putting lime in there, but I thought after listening to some of your shows that perhaps I might be okay due to the winter and all the moisture we got this spring and the resting period that it had before I used it again.
No, lime changes the pH, but it's not going to add phosphorus or potassium. You need to get some green sand in there, some potash, some natural elements to not only add the potassium and phosphorus, but to make sure that the abundance of nitrogen you have in there doesn't prevent fruiting. If you go on our website, if you go to youbetyourgarden.org, go to Garden Answers A to Z, look up fertilizers and it'll tell you, or even using manures wisely, because it'll tell you how to balance out using manures in your garden.
Okay. So maybe I shouldn't get that material again for soil?
Well, where are you getting it? In what form?
I got like a truckload, essentially, from a place out in Mushroom Country, Pennsylvania.
Okay.
And I actually lost my source. I was going to get some more this year, but I couldn't find them.
Oh, okay. Hawk Valley and Laurel Valley are two suppliers of mushroom soil. And anytime you buy from either of those, if you ask for it, you can get a sheet that'll tell you how much nitrogen, phosphorus, and potassium is in it and any contaminants or anything like that. So you'd be working with some knowledge to begin with. But I like good old-fashioned yard waste compost. If you were to start shredding up all your fall leaves and mixing those in with some of your chicken bedding, you'd create compost that was very balanced.
Mm-hmm. I don't really know how to harvest my chicken bedding.
Isn't there bedding on the floor of the chicken coop?
So I have a very external, homemade, very large chicken enclosure And over the winters, I often allowed my chickens to free range during like fall, like after growing season. But I stopped doing that just actually at the end of the day only sometimes. Because
are there any wood shavings or straw on the bottom of the chicken coop?
So inside, yes, I do have that.
Okay. So when the leaves come down in the fall, shred up as many of them as you can. Mix those up in a big pile with the sweepings from when you clean out the floor, and that will cook down into a well-rounded compost that'll have all the nutrients you want, but not too much nitrogen.
Okay. And how long before that's ready?
When it looks like soil.
Okay. Sounds good.
All right.
So basically what's wrong is that I probably don't have the right combination of nitrogen, phosphorus, and potassium.
Yeah, you're all nitrogen. You're all manure. You're full of manure.
Oh, gosh. I'm not the first time someone said that to me. Just kidding.
Okay,
right,
but
then.
Yeah, once you get those shredded fall leaves in there, they contain all the other nutrients and micronutrients you need. The chicken waste will really heat it up. You'll make really high-quality compost, 1 to 2 inches fresh on top of your raised beds, and you'll grow great crops.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Terry, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hello.
Hello, Terry. How are you?
I'm special. Thank you.
All right. And where is Terry special?
In Xenia, Ohio, near Dayton, Ohio.
Okay, very good. We love our listeners. You're one of the YSO listeners, right, out of Yellow Springs.
That's true.
Right, the YSOs, they call themselves
there.
All right, what can we do for Terry in Ohio?
We have two hydrangea bushes here that have been here for as long as we've lived here, which is 10 or 12 years. And we haven't seen any blooms for quite a long time, perhaps as much as 2 or 3 years. Wondering what we could do to encourage them to bloom.
Well, about 2 or 3 years ago, we had a series of winters that pretty much prevented anybody in the mid-Atlantic, even going into the Midwest, from having hydrangea blooms. Either there was a very warm winter and then a freezing cold stretch after the plants started to bloom, or just the reverse. Winter came down hard before the plants had hardened off. But the past 2 years, that has not happened. And this year, I can vouch for the fact that I have great bloom on my hydrangeas. So let's see if we can figure out if you're doing anything wrong. Are you pruning them?
Yes, we cut back all of the dead growth back in the spring, and we water them regularly.
Okay. And have you always done that?
Yes, we have.
Okay. You should not be pruning your hydrangeas like that. Hydrangeas are very funny plants. Some hydrangeas bloom on what's called old wood. That's the nasty-looking sticky stuff that hangs around in the wintertime that nobody likes to look at. Some hydrangeas bloom on new wood, which would theoretically be all the young shoots that come up in the spring. But, you know, a lot of hydrangeas have not been told exactly what they are, so they really don't know whether it's old wood or new wood. And there's really only one sure way to prune hydrangeas. And I apologize for this because hydrangeas are not four-season plants. Let's face it. There's very little as unattractive as a hydrangea in the wintertime. But you pretty much have to eat that. And then what happens in the spring, you leave them alone, and then you wait for the flower heads to form. If you have a fairly normal season, I almost guarantee that flower heads will begin to form in late spring. And then you hold off as long as you can when you have a plant that maybe now is looking a little overgrown, but it's got a lot of flowers on it. You pick a nice day, you go out there with the pruners, and you get to take off any shoots that do not have flowers on them. Don't worry about where they are or what they're doing, what their children's names are. Anything that doesn't have a flower on it is fair game. And your goal here is not to stimulate any kind of new growth or stimulate flowering. What you literally want to do is get rid of the branches that are hiding the flowers. To my mind, it's the only plant that is pruned this way. But it always is successful, no matter what kind of hydrangea you have. pruning at the wrong time of year can always remove the flower buds, or if we have a late frost, it can make the plant frost sensitive, and that can kill flowers that would have otherwise appeared. So again, in the late spring, wait until the flower heads have formed, then get rid of as many non-flowering branches as you want, and it will look like you have more flowers on your hydrangea than anybody else on the planet.
Do I cut down near the base or someplace in between the base and where the flower would be?
There's no reason not to go down all the way to the base to cut away a non-flowering branch.
Okay.
And that'll also open the plant up to better airflow. Watering, you should only be watering if you haven't had rain for a week. I know they always seem to look like they need water. They're real drama queens when it gets dry. But they'll do fine if they just get 1 inch of water a week. And don't feed them any kind of high nitrogen or chemical fertilizer.
Well, you answered my questions. I sincerely appreciate it.
All right. Well, good luck, sir.
Thank you.
Thank you. Take care.
Bye.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and announce that I will speak about the importance of luring bug-eating birds to your garden beds at the American Birding Expo in Oaks, PA on Saturday, September 22nd. But don't go looking for all the details at the events section of our website just yet, because we'll be right back to stop skeeters and take more of your fabulous phone calls. I'm Mike McGrath, and you're listening to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia.
Support for You Bet Your Garden is provided by the Espoma Company, offering a complete selection of natural organic plant foods and potting soils. More information about Espoma and the Espoma Natural Gardening Community can be found at espoma.com.
Coming up later in the show, in the spring, we told you how to prevent mosquitoes. Now that it's prime time for those biting foes, we will tell you how to protect yourself against the ones you did not prevent, with a special focus on attracting beautiful dragonflies to your landscape. You won't want to miss it, and you won't. It's coming up after lots more of your fabulous phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Chris, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hey, Mike, how are you?
I am just ducky today. Chris, how are you doing, sir?
I'm doing very well today. Thanks for taking my call.
Well, thank you for making it. Where are you, Chris?
I am in Newtown Square, Pennsylvania.
Okay, just outside of Philadelphia. Very nice area. What can we do you for?
Last weekend, my wife and I were trying to figure out our final arrangements. We had a child recently, so we're trying to figure out our will and our living will and things like that. And eventually the topic of what we want to do after we pass away came up. And to my surprise, I was able to talk my wife into having us buried. I've seen these different urns where you can be buried underground and you can plant a tree on top of the urn and your body almost turns into nutrients for the tree. So she's open to that idea. We're just not quite sure what type of tree might be a good one to choose. She's interested in something that would be native to the Northeast, something that would obviously last a while and be resistant to different diseases.
Well, first of all, congratulations, because this is something that a lot of people put off, and then it's left up to the kids at a crisis time to decide. So good for you for even just talking about it and getting the paperwork done. Now, I will have to start out by saying that there are many legal issues here. So anything I tell you right now is theoretic. I am not giving you burial advice for the state of Pennsylvania. Now, where do you expect your ashes to reside? One of the things I always think about is, for instance, after you're gone, are your kids going to keep the house? Is there some sort of protected land? I mean, you know, the house gets sold, they bulldoze down your tree, and all of a sudden you have restless spirits rattling the chains at night.
Right.
So have you given any thought to where this would be?
No, because to your point, I haven't looked into it too much, but I know that there would be some ordinances and legal issues involved. So I haven't figured those details out.
Yeah, more than the horticultural aspect, I would think about the permanency thing. I mean, that's one of the good things about quote-unquote graveyards is they're kind of insisting that you're going to be safe there, you know, that,
right.
that nobody's going to build the used-to-be-a-graveyard acres over time. So one thing that you have going in your favor is green burials like the one you described are getting more popular around the country. But in your immediate area, in the Philadelphia area, there is a fabulous facility known as Laurel Hill.
Okay.
And they're right on, I know I'm supposed to call it the Kelly Drive, but it's the East River Drive, okay? I grew up in Philadelphia. And it is an historical landmark. It's been there for centuries, and they have a new area that they're devoting to green burials. And I believe one of the types is very much like you're describing. You would not be in an urn, for instance, I would not think. The urn would be impenetrable. You would be in some sort of cloth or heavy-duty paper that would disintegrate over time and give the tree access to your remains. And you're right. Your atoms would become part of the atoms of the tree over time. Now, the type of tree, that's so risky. 20 years ago, somebody would have said a magnificent ash tree.
Right.
But now they're being devastated by the emerald ash borer. I just got a book about the loss in America of the beech tree and what was hemlocks. So in terms of what's going to happen over the next 20 years with all these imported pests, all bets are off. But again, and I'm only using Laurel Hill as an example. I think more and more funeral directors and more cemeteries are leaning into this green burial thing. And the two things that are nice about that is you're kind of guaranteed that the ground will be kept nice and that nothing's going to change it, you know, for about as long as anybody can figure. And then everything would be done in accordance with local laws. And instead of in a private home, for instance, you would be in a public place where your family, your children, their children could come. And it would be a wonderful family story. In terms of the tree, if I had to pick, I would pick a flowering cherry tree.
That sounds nice.
Yeah, well, you want that symbol of rebirth in there no
right.
matter what.
Yeah.
And flowering cherries are beautiful, and then the weeping form, the pendulous form of the weeping cherry is just heartbreakingly beautiful in the spring. And so far, cherries are proving to be fairly resistant. Now, if you wanted to be guaranteed that your plant would never die, I would
get a plastic one then?
No, I'd be under a forsythia.
Okay.
I would be under a forsythia, a magnificent spring-blooming shrub that easily gets to the height of most trees. A forsythia unclipped would easily reach 20 feet, and they are invulnerable. And in the spring, they are covered with beautiful yellow flowers that are very attractive to pollinators. They're very healthy trees, and again, you've got that rebirth. You've got that symbol of spring, which I think you would want to incorporate into this.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. I think that'd be it's great to have.
Yeah,
and a feature like that, like a bloom.
Yeah, you'd kind of have a hedge on visitors too. You want to go visit grandma and grandpa? Well, if we're going to do it, let's go now while they're in bloom.
Right. Don't forget to rake the leaves around grandpa.
Yeah, that's right. Grandpa might be in the leaves. You don't know. All right. All right. So you got some stuff to think about. A visit to Laurel Hill is great. I mean, it's a destination, and I think you'd also get some new ideas there.
Thank you, Mike. This is really good advice. So I feel like I'm on a better path now with this. So thanks so much for your time.
Yeah, physical reality is one of the issues here in addition to the horticulture. You want to make sure your site would be protected.
Right. Okay. All right. Well, thank you, Mike.
All right. Good luck, Chris. And don't use this advice anytime soon, okay?
You got it.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Michelle, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hello.
Hello, Michelle. How are you?
I'm very well. Thank you. I am from Manayunk, but I'm calling from King of Prussia, outside of the Philadelphia Metro Wildlife Clinic, where I am volunteer assistant director.
Oh, okay. So you are a director at a wildlife clinic. Is this where people...
I am a state-licensed wildlife clinic, a wildlife hospital for where wild animals get hurt and they're brought by members of the public.
Right. So if we find an owl with a broken wing, we bring it to you.
Correct.
That's great work. Thank you for doing that. It must be emotionally rewarding, but not financially.
You got it exactly. So I am at the forefront of when animals and the human world collide and animals get hurt. And it's usually things like cars or hit by windows, but a new problem has occurred in the last month. We have gotten about 10 different animals stuck in the spotted lanternfly sticky paper that has been brought onto the market to control the really bad spotted lanternfly problem.
Let me interrupt you there, because our listeners around the country don't know about this pest yet. They will soon enough. But the spotted lanternfly is a crazy-looking invasive insect from Asia. It looks like a circus clown, really. Mm. And it has been spotted in southeastern Pennsylvania and is slowly spreading county by county. Now, just the other day, I was driving to an area called Harleysville, and there was a feed store that had a big sign outside, "We now have spotted lanternfly supplies." Is this what they mean? They're using sticky traps, sticky paper?
I think so. So this paper, these are like, it's like a glue trap for mice, but it's really big, like, you know, a couple feet long and a couple feet wide. I don't know how it's applied to the tree, but I know that it's applied to the tree and it's catching. We have gotten several big brown bats stuck to it.
Oh.
We've gotten at least 5 woodpeckers of various types stuck to it. And we even got a red-tailed hawk stuck
no.
to it.
No!
Which are huge hawks.
I know.
He survived, but got most of his feathers pulled out. But a lot of the smaller birds died in really, you know, really struggling, awful situation.
Well, every single creature you just mentioned is a tremendous predator of pest insects and vermin.
Especially bats. So we posted this on Facebook, and I got a lot of vitriol. I'll probably get death threats for being on this program because people are very angry that I dared to suggest that we don't do something about the spotted lanternfly problem. And that's not what I'm saying at all.
That's so bogus.
It's not a zero-sum game. We can control this really bad invasive insect, but maybe my plea here, my reason for calling today, is to help that someone somewhere can come up with some solution that is not killing animals.
Now, a couple of questions. You say this is like rolls of wallpaper. This isn't small stuff here.
It was like everything that people, some people cut the animal out, and so I haven't seen the actual product in its package,
mm-hmm.
but the one that the woodpecker, the most recent downy woodpecker came on, it was about 2 feet long and a foot wide.
Wow.
And not stiff. It was like very thin, bendable paper.
And did you find any lantern flies on the paper?
Yes, a couple times it was covered. So this is effective for lanternfly, but it's catching other things.
You know, traps like this in the wild, so to speak, to begin with, if we were talking about a farm here or something like that, we would have the lanternfly traps out, hopefully in an amended manner. But
right.
It would just be
maybe a cage.
Yeah, it would be to tell us that the first lanternfly has shown up.
Mm-hmm.
And then you go about your business of then bringing out your sprays or whatever you're going to do to protect your crop. Very rarely are sticky traps used for control. They're used for monitoring most
mm-hmm.
of the time.
Apparently a lot of scientists, you know, this has been the method that has been the most pushed and the most promoted, I've learned since posting this on Facebook. People are like, well, there's nothing else we can do. And you'd rather, like, we lose all these billions of dollars of agricultural revenue just to save a few animals. And I think, well, like you pointed out rightly, we're on the side of science as well. Bats are threatened, and they are incredibly important to the environment as well.
When you put this on Facebook, you posted pictures, right?
Correct.
You're
mm-hmm.
you're telling me people looked at these pictures and still were defending the sticky paper.
A lot of them called it just, well, animals are going to have to be collateral damage.
I've seen images of creatures stuck to sticky traps, and it's terrible.
The most recent downy woodpecker was the worst. He really struggled and came across all bloody and exhausted and dying.
And they're so and they're so useful.
They're fantastic. And I think some people wrap this stuff around the tree, just where a woodpecker would creep up the tree.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, there has been a technique called tree banding in which paper is wrapped around the tree, but the sticky part of the paper faces inward because this is to trap a creature that breeds in the soil and then walks up the trunk to get to the canopy. So the paper is created so it's easy for the insect to walk underneath it, and then they get trapped.
That sounds much better. I hope someone listening, you know, I hope maybe this will prompt someone to come up with something that's not going to hurt animals, but will control this awful problem.
I think you hit it on the head. I may have cut you off a little bit, but you said a cage. And I think to be responsible here, you really do need to cage this material. It could be as simple as, you know, you actually get like a suet cage.
Mm-hmm.
Suet cages, you can buy them real cheap. If you feed the birds in the winter like I do, you got a dozen in the house. You put the sticky paper inside the suet cage.
Right, and chicken wire on a larger scale.
And then you hang that up, and the lantern fly is still going to get in.
Mm-hmm.
But the larger creatures wouldn't be able to access it. And
right.
Yeah, I think chicken wire, because of the size of the openings, would be just the right size to catch the lantern fly, but not have enough surface area to hold. I can't believe this stuff held down a red-tailed hawk.
Yeah.
They're like the Hulk.
Yeah, they're like, you know, at least a kilogram and a half usually. And it took out all his tail feathers and his wing feathers. He, because of his size, he wasn't super injured, and he just needs to regrow all his feathers. But he could be a parent at this time.
Aren't raptors in general protected, period?
Yeah, all migratory birds are protected by the Migratory Bird Act.
And the bats, aren't the bats protected?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
So, you know, one would think that the use of this material in this way might ostensibly even be illegal, certainly if you can prove that there was this unnecessary capture.
I don't know. People are allowed to let their cats out to kill migratory birds all the time, knowing that they do it and they're not prosecuted. So that's another whole issue.
But I think your idea of a cage is good. I like the idea of the individual suet cages. I think they'd give you a better reading on how many lantern flies you had. If you really want to wrap it around the trunk of a tree, why not surround that with chicken wire? I don't think, you know, a small bat might get caught in that, a little brown bat, which would still be terrible. But I don't think any larger birds would get trapped, and it would be good for the insects.
Mm-hmm.
Or if you want to go for the gold, get some hardware cloth and actually, you know, make a little structure. Make it like an inch away from the tree so you have to fly through the hardware cloth. And then get to the sticky paper. But, you know, somebody who's handy can do that and make the paper underneath replaceable. You know, all you got to do is think about how do you make sure little guys can get in, but big things can't, you know, whenever, you know, when you're protecting a planting from deer or birds and you have to do a full-size cage, you make sure the bees can get through.
Mm-hmm.
But I'll tell you, from a scientific standpoint, I'm trying to think, and there really is no pest control that relies completely on this kind of trapping. Because what you find is, for instance, if that trap is scented with a lure, with a sex lure or something, you're just going to be bringing more into the area.
Mm-hmm.
The trapping is meant to alert you to start your real control, never to just take care of things like this completely.
Right.
So, I mean, I thank you for bringing this to our attention. You've broken my heart for the day.
Sorry.
But I think this has a wider scale. Before anybody uses any kind of sticky thing like this out in the open, randomly, think about these unwanted catches. Think about this collateral damage.
And get ready for the angry phone calls you're going to get for daring to suggest that we don't do this. I was really shocked.
Bring them on, baby. Bring them on. That's why I'm here. All right, Michelle, keep doing your wonderful work, and I'll keep what you've told me in mind.
Thank you for listening.
Oh, thank you very much for bringing it to our attention.
Bye-bye.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and announce that I will travel down south to speak about the importance of horticultural therapy when I appear at a very special healing garden on Tuesday, October 23rd at the beautiful Country Club of North Carolina in Pinehurst. But don't go checking the events section of our website for all the details just yet, because we'll be right back to talk about the many ways you can still stop those skeeters and take more of your fabulous phone calls. I'm Mike McGrath, and you're listening to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia.
Support for You Bet Your Garden is provided by the Esfoma Company, offering a complete selection of natural organic plant foods and potting soils. More information about Esfoma and the Esfoma Natural Gardening Community can be found at espoma.com.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I am your host, Mike McGrath, and we're in the stretch now, cats and kittens. In just a little bit, we'll get to the question of the week. When prevention of mosquitoes has failed, what do you turn to for safe protection? We're going to get that protection in the form of the famed mosquito hawk, review the safe repellents you can use, and come up with even a couple more ideas right after a couple more of your fabulous phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Ellen, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi.
Hello, Ellen.
Thanks for taking my call.
Well, thank you for making it, Ellen. Where are you?
Elverson, Pennsylvania.
Oh, help me out. I almost know where that is.
Well, do you know the Turnpike and the Morgantown exit?
Yes, I do.
Okay, Elverson touches Morgantown on Route 23.
Oh, okay, that's nice horse country out there.
Oh, yeah. On my son's property, he has this big, beautiful tulip tree that has just grown beautifully for years and years. But this spring, the last couple of weeks, I noticed that the outside of the leaves are shiny, and the underside of the leaves have little brown spots all over them, and then the branches have these little nodules all over them. They were kind of grayish green. They're right next to each other in big clusters. They look like hives, and then they started to get brown circles in the middle, and the leaves are dying and falling off the tree.
Now, when you say tulip tree, I presume you mean the tulip poplar tree?
Yeah, where the leaves look like tulips.
Yes, exactly. And the flowers, actually, when they drop in the spring, look like tulips. And they're very tall, straight trees.
Yes.
I have a ton of tulip poplar trees. They're a pain in the butt. They are not necessarily a tree anybody would plant deliberately. But like silver maples, they show up all over the place. I wouldn't call them unhealthy trees, but they have bad habits. They attract aphids, which may be one of the symptoms you're seeing. Look underneath that tree. See if the ground is sticky. See if there's any furniture under there that's got a sticky residue on it. I have a tulip poplar tree that's infested with aphids this season, and it's a pain in the butt. It was dripping on my tomato plants when they were growing up. How dare the thing. I also notice, and this freaks people out every year, but tulip poplars are the first trees to drop their leaves. And my tulip poplars have been shedding their leaves for a week or two now. I've actually had to rake up the yard. Some trees just naturally do this. It's just a function of them. Tulip poplars are very early to leaf out. And it really only takes a couple of months for a tree to photosynthesize, to get enough solar energy to help guide it through the next year. So the tree shouldn't be harmed long term. I'm not quite sure about the knots and lesions and cankers you're seeing, though. That's not something I associate with a tulip poplar.
It's never had that before, and I can't see way up into the canopy, but the lower branches, the thinner the branch, the more of those cankers, that's a good description, there are on it. And they've gone from green-gray to having a circle of brownish-orange in the middle.
Mm-hmm. How tall would you say the tree is?
I would say maybe 30 feet tall.
Okay, so it's not even half-grown yet.
Really?
Oh, no, not if it's a tulip poplar.
Holy smoke.
Oh, yeah, no, they're some of the tallest trees in the forest. So these diseased limbs, are they reachable, say, on an extension ladder?
They're even closer than just an extension ladder. Yeah, the ones that I can see that are lower are, within cutting.
Well,
my son wants to cut them.
Is the tree mulched or anything like that?
No. The only big problem is about 12 years ago, they had one of those septic systems put in with a hill in the back. And it seems as though the yard has sunk a bit. And with this wet spring, there have been areas in the backyard where it stayed wet and puddly for quite a while. It was very, very swampy. And as a result, we've got a lot of mosquitoes and gnats and stuff.
Okay. So that's three things. First of all, that could be what's wrong with the tree. Anytime a tree stands in water, they're going to slowly die. Number two, I want you to go to our website. I want you to go to youbetyourgarden.org. Under Garden Answers A to Z, search mosquitoes, and I want you to get some BTI. That's an all-natural larvicide. Throw it in those wet areas, and it'll prevent more mosquitoes breeding. And then you're going to have to call the septic company and have the sand mound inspected. It sounds like it's failed. Yes, that's bad news. But let's have them send a scope down there and see what's going on before things start coming back into the house that were supposed to stay out of the house. And then whatever they do to fix that should improve the drainage. The tree should be fine in future years. And read up on BTI and be ready to protect yourself next spring. There's no reason that wet areas on your property should breed mosquitoes. You are totally in control of that.
Okie doke.
All right?
Yep.
Sorry. Good luck.
Thank you very, very much for your help.
My pleasure. You take care.
All right. Bye-bye.
1-888-346-9499. Merrill, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi there, Mike. How are you doing?
I am just ducky today, Merrill. How are you?
I am doing well in DeKalb County, Tennessee, outside of the little town of Smithville, Dowelltown, Alexandria. You can save me from the bean beetles.
Oh, Mexican bean beetles. They're nasty. And aren't their larvae ugly? Aren't they especially, like, nasty and slimy and terrible looking?
Well, they're actually not too bad looking. The little grubs that eat the leaves of the bean plants are very pretty. They're yellow
pretty?
And fuzzy. And when you squash them, you know, your hands drip yellow like they've been dipped in liquid sunshine. Nothing like the Asian lady beetles. Those are awful.
No, they're not. They don't eat your plants. The Asian lady beetles, if, for instance, they infest your house in the fall and winter, if they congregate in one area in a room up in the top of your house, as they often do, you go up there with a canister vacuum cleaner and an empty bag with a little raffia straw stuffed in it. You suck them all into the bag. You spritz some water in the bag. You seal it up, put it in a fridge. And then when the bean beetles come out, you wait until the early evening. You soak your plants with water. You bust open the bag over top. And the Asian lady beetles and their larvae will eat those nasty cousins of theirs, the Mexican bean beetle.
Oh, my gosh, is that what they eat? Well, where I used to live, they infested the entire house.
They're dual. They're a pest in the house, but outside they're beneficial. So are we talking flat earth gardening, raised beds, and what do you feed the plants?
Well, this particular place now is flat earth. It's a bottomland. It's really, really good soil. I've been here for
years. Sure. And all the other
garden it.
All the other girls like it too. So what are you feeding these plants?
They get water, they get hay mulch, and I'm not really feeding them anything yet. My plants are enormous.
So how deep is this hay mulch? Do you really need it to keep moisture in the soil and to suppress weeds?
Well, I mostly need it to keep the grass down right now. It's maybe an inch, and it's very well composted.
Let me cut to the chase. If you build raised beds, grass will no longer invade your garden, and you'll get your life back over the summertime. And so what I want you to do now, because it sounds like you're in a kind of a rural area, this should work well, is I want you to attract toads. They are one of the biggest predators of Mexican bean beetles.
Okay, good.
I want you to get a couple of bird bath saucers, not the pedestals, just the saucers. Fill them with water, sink them into the ground around the area you're having these problems, and fill them with water. And then somewhere nearby, the first area of shade that is anywhere near this planting, I want you to, underneath the shade, put a couple of bricks down, two bricks, three bricks on each side, put a board on top of those bricks, and then cover the board with old carpeting or soil or containers or something. And toads will come and live in that toad abode, that cool, shady spot, during the day. And then they'll come out at night. They'll be attracted to the water, and they want to eat your bean beetles. It is one of their favorite foods, and every toad will eat its own weight in pest insects every evening.
That sounds great. Should I put a little BTI in the water there? Do I need to do that?
It's summertime. Just rinse it out once a week. It gets pretty foul after 4 or 5 days. Just bring a hose over and slam it all out and fill it with fresh water.
Okay, and what about the mosquitoes?
Mosquitoes take 7 to 10 days to breed. So if you empty out and refill the containers every 4 or 5 days.
Great.
All right?
Great. Okay, we'll bring those toads on around this side of the house.
And then next year, raised beds.
Yes.
All right, Merrill. Good luck.
Okay, thank you very much.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
All right. As promised, it is time for the question of the week. Got skeeters bad? Call in the dragonflies. Brett Rader, newly crowned producer of You Bet Your Garden, please get us started with this week's question.
Sure, Mike. Ethan in Brokaw, Wisconsin writes, I'm a 13-year-old boy and I live with my grandparents on 7 acres of land. We have a pond, but absolutely no dragonflies. We're way out in the country and you'd think we'd have plenty, but we haven't seen any. It's like they vanished. Is there any kind of smell or food we could use to attract them? We need them badly. I just counted 30 bites on my legs. Bug spray has been no help, so our only hope is dragonflies.
You know, let's stop right here and offer some instant help, although Ethan probably isn't going to like it.
Let me guess. He should be wearing long pants.
Specifically, white ones. Yes, I realize that long white pants are the totally incorrect uniform for a 13-year-old country boy in the summer, but it would prevent those leg bites while we ramp up with some other measures. I suggest that Ethan's grand folks treat a couple pair of long white pants with a spray-on tick repellent, available at stores that sell hunting and camping supplies. That spray will contain 0.1% permethrin, a synthetic version of a natural insecticide obtained from the flowers of a specific type of chrysanthemum.
But that's tick repellent. Isn't DEET the main chemical repellent for mosquitoes?
Yes, but while DEET does not work against ticks, permethrin-treated clothing does repel mosquitoes and chiggers, which might actually be the major itch inducer at play here.
Why chiggers? Is it because Ethan says that only his legs are getting bitten up?
Exactly right. Chiggers and fleas are low-level biters, working from the ankles up to around the knees for fleas and all the way up to the waist for chiggers. Permethrin-treated clothing, which is also available professionally pre-treated from a company called Insect Shield, would keep all of those biters, and ticks, of course, off of this poor kid's bit-up legs.
All right, well, what if it works for his legs, but then his arms start getting bitten up?
Treated white long-sleeve shirts. And one of the EPA-approved mosquito repellents that don't contain DEET to protect his face and neck. Lemon eucalyptus and picardin are two active ingredients that have been shown to be as effective as DEET, which is toxic, a solvent, and doesn't seem to be working here anyway. Now, let's finish up Ethan's email.
Ethan continues, my grandparents say that the dragonflies don't come around anymore because of all the chemicals farmers spray on their crops, which we're surrounded by. And our pond is small, the size of a queen-size bed. But my little baby snapping turtle loves it, and we hope it's big enough to get the dragonflies back.
Now, the pesticide spraying is a good theory. Dragonflies are voracious predators of mosquitoes, eating twice their weight in the nasty bloodsuckers every day. And those mosquitoes are probably loaded with pesticides that are going to build up to higher levels in the dragonflies' bodies. The perils of the food chain.
Other than that, can dragonflies even be attracted? And to a pond that small?
Absolutely. And I have to apologize here, as our archives contain a previous question of the week that discusses exactly how to attract dragonflies, but it didn't have the word dragonfly in the title, just their common name of mosquito hawk. Anyway, that link has been fixed, and here's the short scoop from that article delivered by one of our favorite entomologists, Dr. Linda Gilkinson. Entice them with perches, narrow, upright stakes that extend well beyond any plants in the area. Dr. Gilkison has found that bamboo poles placed in a kind of zigzag pattern about 3 to 4 feet high are the best attractors.
Oh, here, I have the article too. She continues, position your perches where they'll be in full sun at the middle of the day, when dragonflies are most active. And the more stakes, the merrier. Dr. Gilkison says that there's a dragonfly at the top of every one of her perches on most summer days, each one looking like a bright jewel on the head of a pin. How neat.
And as always, when you're attracting any kind of beneficials, whether they be toads, insects, birds, or Batman, it is virtually important to avoid pesticides, which kill the good guys faster than they can harm the bad guys.
Batman?
Just read your line, Robin.
Ethan should also treat that pond with BTI to make sure that it isn't the source of his mosquito miseries. Specifically, he should shake some BTI granules into the water to make a quick knockdown of any developing larvae, and then toss one of those donut-shaped dunks into the water for long-term control.
And as we always remind our listeners, all natural BTI only prevents mosquito breeding. It does not harm birds, butterflies, dragonflies, people, pets...
or Batman. It doesn't harm me either.
I'm Batman.
No, I'm Batman.
I'm Batman.
No, I'm the Batman.
I'm Batman.
I've got the cape on.
I'm Batman. It looks terrible on you. Well, that sure was a hopefully helpful look at late-season skeeter protection, now wasn't it? Luckily, the question of the week appears in print at the Gardens Alive website. To read it over at your leisure or leisure, just click the link for the question of the week at our website, youbetyourgarden.org. Gardens Alive supports the You Bet Your Garden question of the week, and you will always find the latest question of the week at the Gardens Alive website. Yikes, my producer is threatening to feed me to the skeeters if I don't get out of this studio. We must be out of time. But you can call us anytime at 1-888-346-9499. Or send us your email, your tired, your poor, your wretched refuse teeming towards our garden shore at garden@whyy.org. Please include your location. Please, please, please. And visit our website, youbetyourgarden.org, where nobody cares about your location, but where you will find the answers to all those garden questions you are going to ask us, audio of this show, past shows, and our priceless podcast. Ken Queter plays our theme song. Our vice president of production is Terry Murray. Elizabeth Perez Luna is executive producer of audio content for WHYY. Our engineer this week is Diana Martinez. Our social media director is Amanda McGrath. Check out her fine work and stay current with the show at the You Bet Your Garden Facebook page. Larissa Sapko and Rich Banowitz keep our website bite-free. Our editor, Al Banks, is all bit up. Our former associate producer of Production Association and now full-fledged producer, Brett Rader, well, he doesn't have enough meat on his bones to interest no mosquitoes. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and I'm so tough I bite mosquitoes back. And that's why I'll see you again next week.